And now, The Trash Can Sinatras, a documentary by Ken Sweeney.
On Radio Nova. Seriously addictive.
When we were first getting together as songwriters, we would do it in each other's bedrooms, and Frank and Paul lived in one edge of town, so I'd find ourselves walking through the town to get to their house. And in summer nights, around about 9 or 10, that's when the street lamps would go on and they'd cast this orange haze over the town. And I found myself walking through that light all the time, whether it was 4 in the morning going home or 9, 10 at night. And it was just a constant colour that was in the air. And it ended up in a song called Orange Veil.
This is Irvine Beach on the west coast of Scotland. It's in a kind of bay type thing, quite a big broad bay, looking over the water, and over there is Arran. This is where I used to come with my pals.
With the trash cans
and everyone else our age that was hip and cool. You'd stand out like a sore thumb in our town if you look good. If you're into good music and you dress different, so it could be quite a terrorising experience being in town at night. But down here at the beach, it's a couple of miles away from the town centre. But back then, it was quite a quiet walk. You'd be walking past factories, but when you get to the beach, it's gorgeous, and there'd be plenty of driftwood. And then there's a stretch of maybe 200 or 300 yards of sand. Those nights where we'd come down here after the pub and you'd grab some driftwood and get a fire going and sit around with your pals to the early hours talking about the latest record you heard at the football, or who's kissing who, or who's falling out with who. And just, you know, growing up, very formative part of our growing up was this. It was like
this stretch of beach.
Yeah, it was a harbour. It's a harbour for us, just sort of psychologically. You were away from the worries of the being in the town. When we were here, we'd be safe, and you could chat to the early hours. No one would chase you, no one would bother you. And it was gorgeous surroundings.
Scotland's Trash Can Sinatras have created some of the saddest, most beautiful music you've ever heard. Laments for the lovesick and world-weary, coupled with the jangliest of pop. They've landed and lost a record deal and overcome every kind of adversity to release 6 wonderful albums you need to hear. I'm Ken Sweeney, and they're going to join me to tell their story. It begins with a bunch of bin lids on the west coast of Scotland.
The government would have these 3-month schemes where you would get your dole money plus a fiver to go somewhere. Frank and Davy Hughes were on one where it was like an arts project they had to do, to go to some place for a month and by the end of it have a thing. And some people would do maybe write something or whatever, but they decided they would do a gig at the end of the thing. And I think Davy had a guitar and he knew the chords to The Lady as a Tramp. So he knew that, quite fancy. And Frank just adjusted the words a bit, and I think there's a guy called Paul Ford who was a drummer. He might have been on the same course, and I think he had there wasn't drums, but there was bins, so he played the
trash
bins.
Cans.
He played the trash cans, the bins, and that's they decided to call himself for the day the Trash Can Sinatras, because they were singing a sort of Sinatra song and playing the drums.
The young group did their first gig soon after, playing covers by the Velvet Underground and the Clash. Next to arrive was local musician John Douglas. Then, young guitar player Paul Livingston.
I was in my first band called The Shock Club, and we used to rehearse at this community centre in Irvine, where a bunch of bands rehearsed. And the guy who set up the rehearsal room, he was the drummer in the Trash Cans, and he just sort of said, when my band split up, he was like, oh, you could, my wee jazzy band, the Trash Cans, are looking for a guitarist. And I thought, God, that sounds horrible. Jazzy band.
But Paul did join that wee jazzy band. Once the lineup started playing together, they realised they had an immediate chemistry. Soon they were writing and recording their own songs.
Frank had got work in a studio in a town 5 miles away. He got us in to do some demo time. So we started making just really rudimentary demos of the songs that we come up. And one of them got played on Billy Sloan's show on, the, I think it was Radio Clyde at the time, which was a big buzz. And Frank and Paul started sending tapes off to companies in London.
The Trash Cans got an immediate response from A&R man Simon Dine of record label Go Discs, home of the Lads and the House Martins.
They were interested in us, and then they were like, you know, you don't really have the killer song yet. We like your songs, but we don't really hear a potential hit. And then we wrote Obscurity and Ox, and that was that.
I think I got this. I had that feel. Paul caught with this riff.
Always at the foot of the photographs, lets me there, snug as a thug in a mugshot pose of all my throat. Owner of this corner, not much more, still these.
And then I think the next journey for me, I think with that song, was just hearing what Frank did to it melodically. And suddenly it just became this Technicolor, you know, thing that it is today.
We knew kind of straight off the bat that we were going to sign to GoDisc, because all the other people were A&R people. Andy McDonald was the guy in charge, and he was chasing after us. And, you know, we liked him, and he said the right things. He was going to give us time to write more songs. He wasn't going to rush us into making an album. But yeah, there was times when I just, you know, you have to pinch yourself. You're like, oh my God, we're going to get a record deal and never have to work a normal job. That's what I thought.
Signing to Go Discs, the Trash Cans made a clever decision. They decided to use their advance to buy a local studio where they could take time to record their debut album.
We were kind of knew that we didn't really have a full album's worth of songs by the time they signed us. So we knew we had to do a lot of groundwork.
You had to start work.
Yeah, there was no concept of us going to a producer and just making a record. We had to do stuff.
Yeah.
But it was early days, you know, but they saw the raw talent, the raw kind of goodness in what we were doing. And I think Frank came up with the idea.
You buy the studio?
Yeah, buy the studio off the owners.
Sirocco, is that what it was called?
Yeah, we changed the name. It'll become ours and it'll become our place.
Why did you call it Shabby Road?
Oh, God. And we were just stuck for a name.
But is that a Ruttles thing or something?
Well, I didn't know that at the time. We discovered that afterwards. No, we just thought it's a daft name and it's kind of like Abbey Road, and it's similar to the Trash Can Sonatas. It's slightly funny, but it's giving a nod to something that's great.
Thirty-five years later, I'm back at Shabby Road with Trash Can's guitarist John.
There's a fella. How you doing? You all right? How you doing?
John describes the building that was once Shabby Road Studios.
Yeah, I would say it's like a two-story brownstone in New York. You know, old slate roof, lots of piping on the outside. When you get inside, they're big rooms, big high-ceilinged rooms with cornicing around the edges. Is it Victorian, maybe? Georgian? I don't know.
We made three albums here. A lot of B-sides, a lot of singles. Pretty much everything from the first period was here, the first three records.
I'm looking at the building here. It's kind of an industrial place, and it doesn't seem to tie up to this wonderful kind of acoustic, sad, beautiful music that the Trash Cans made, because it's on the verges of an industrial estate.
Well, I think that's very apt. We were very industrious people. You know, once the chemistry kicked in and us, this is all we did. We'd get up in the morning and do this and go to bed at night. We just felt really busy. And I remember, like, when I was growing up, my dad used to work in the shipyards, and he spoke to me about the sense of pride he had after they'd worked for maybe a year or so of sending the thing out in the water and seeing it float away. They made something that was going to last and they could be proud of. And I think, you know, as musicians, we did that. We got industrious, we got busy, we took it seriously, and the things we made these beautiful things we sent out into the world.
Back in 1988, the Trash Can Sonatras began work on their debut album.
whenever we were like together with our guitars, we were like, let's try this bit, let's knock that bit next to that bit. And it was mostly just a kind of feeling we were chasing all the time, really. And then we'd think, well, that sounds like a complete song. It just needs kind of like words and music, words and melody now. And I'd take that home and try and come up with certain melodies that, you know, kind of I liked and fit some of John's and my words in.
I got Trashcan's guitarist John into a Dublin studio to remind him of those songs. Do you remember coming up with that?
Yeah. That's Paul's idea, I think, and probably Frank's.
Do you know the verse?
That reminds me of the time I fell. It's time for sinning Catholic guilt. 2 years later to the day I had reason to confess. For the hair a shining shade of bus conductor's blonde. Tales of music and movement were told in grip and groan. Thoughts and songs like this, of the honest truth there'd be no trace, just lying out loud.
Oh, it's beautiful that.
Can you play me
yeah.
that?
Frank's gig.
She says she doesn't like my style,
but I loved her in my own fashion. Kept her under wraps, planted lots of verbal traps, but she won't be gone for long. No, 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 nothing good ever comes of her back. Kick up some dust and ask me what's wrong.
She's a funny. There was no turning the guitar amps up to 11 either, because on that first Trashcan Sinatra's album, there's no amplifiers used. The guitars played by John and Paul went straight into the desk. Shabby Road wasn't just a Trashcan studio, it also contained a bunch of rehearsal rooms used by other bands in the area.
Yeah, the nature of the building was one side was the studio and had a kitchen and an office and places for us to keep, and the other side was 8 or 9 rehearsal rooms, and they were locked. You couldn't get between the two. You had to go outside the building and chap our door to get between the two. And one of the fellas was very thirsty, put it that way, he liked to drink. And,
one of the visitors to the studio?
Yeah, one of the guys in one of the bands that rehearsed pretty regularly. He was a lovely fella, but he loved to drink. And he discovered that in the rehearsal rooms, if he went up through the attic space and crawled over the attic, he could get down into the area where we had a fridge with booze in it. And one night he did this, and of course he didn't manage to make it to the attic exit. He just fell through the plaster ceiling into our kitchen and got the bottle of whiskey. And I think that was the last day we saw him in the studio.
The next thing to drop was the Trashcan's debut LP, Cake, preceded by the Obscurity Knock CP.
The NME gave us Single of the Week for our first single, and it was kind of a grudging Single of the Week. Like, this is one is over, the music on this. So that was a good thing. And just, you know, when you're 16 and you go to the indie disco every week, and then your singles, Single of the Week in NME, you know, that was good enough for me.
But not all the reviews for the first Trash Cans album were ecstatic.
So the reaction wise, I remember it wasn't we weren't being lauded everywhere we went, so I knew that it hadn't been a great success, and I think Godis had a lot of ambition for it, which was great in its way, you know.
Disappointed at the lukewarm reaction, the Trash Cans started work on a second album, little realising the cake had made its way across the ocean to America.
When we got a phone call from the record label saying that they're playing your songs on the radio in America, you need to go over to America.
And it seems crazy now, but we were like, we're over cake. It's been a year and a half or something since it's came out. We're kind of over it. We really don't want to go and do a big tour playing cake songs. And so GoDiscs sent Chaz Smash.
That's Chaz Smash of Madness,
who had just started working for them. They sent him up to Shabby Road to talk us into it. And he basically just came up and says, look, it's great fun. You're going to have a blast. It's a party. We says, will you come? And he said, yeah. And so we're like, okay, let's do it. So we did do it. We did go.
But before the Trash Can Sinatras could go on tour in America, they had to get the approval of another Sinatra, Frank Sinatra, old Blue Eyes himself.
Start spreading the news.
And the Sinatra estate might have been upset about the name in some way, so they wanted to somehow smooth the waters. There was a lady from the American side of the business that was helping us. So she knew somebody at Reprise Records, Sinatra's old label, and so she arranged for us to go in and have a meeting. I was the big Sinatra fan at the band. Yeah. You know, knew just.
So you were meeting Frank Sinatra's people.
Yeah, and then we go to this skyscraper up to the 54th floor, and we're going in this office through various corridors, and into this office, and there's a guy sitting there, chubby, with a suit on. He's going, "Hey, nice to meet you." And it's all photos of him and Frank, him and Sammy Davis, him and, you know, Nick, whoever it is, the president's not right.
That's Frank with Dean Martin. And hey, look, that's Frank with JFK.
And I was just saying, oh man, what a treat it is to be in here. He's been in this office, you know. And he says, come here, come on down. And he took me downstairs to the vaults where they keep the masters. And he took out, he says, this is the vocal master for In the Wee Small Hours of the Morning.
That's the vocal master of the Wee Small Hours of the Morning.
Yes, I got my photograph taken with that. And then he took me upstairs and he says, here, we asked Frank to do this for you guys. And hand me the picture, you know, to John, Paul, George, Frank, Stephen, all the best on your American tour. Stephen, love, Frank Sinatra.
All the best on your American tour, Frank Sinatra.
With Frank Sinatra's backing, the Trash Cans were now free to tour America to fans who knew and loved their music.
We're in a tour bus like you see on the movies, and we're driving through the desert, you know, and going into New York for the first time, which is a stunning experience for anyone. You know, you grew up in the movies and the TV, but to actually be in it, your jaws on the floor.
And the people knew your songs.
Yeah, that was the major thing.
They knew the first album, they knew Obscurity Knocks, they knew the songs on the album.
Yeah.
You've gone into venues and they knew the songs.
Yeah, it was just a radical shift, and everything. Suddenly you're playing to people who you're not converting anyone. Everybody knows all the songs, they're singing along with them, they love them, and they just want you're in the company of friends.
But the Trash Cans didn't make friends with everyone.
You know, you go to America and the whole thing is different there. You know, the bands basically have no power or say. So we were like, you know, we don't do interviews. Also, we didn't like the whole meet and greet thing. Like, don't want record. I mean, the people that distribute your record, like, why do we care who they are? And they were like, look, these people can make the difference between a hit and not a hit. I don't want to meet these folk after a show.
Hi, John.
You know, businessmen.
It's
the whole thing was like not rock and roll. So I think we upset quite a few people in America. Even just saying, look, we don't want to go around in a limo. Can we not just get a van with chairs in it? You know, because when you're like a support band showing up in a big white stretched limo, you're like, this is crazy.
And it was a long tour, so suddenly we became a touring band where every night you're improving. It was a huge learning experience. But the major thing we came away from was we learned a lot about how we play together, yeah. And we learned a lot about if we're doing songs in the future, there's some things we want to avoid and there's some things we want to focus on a bit more. Nothing too intricate or complicated. That's maybe not where we want to go. We want to be more band-orientated, maybe more stripped back.
The Trash Cans put everything they'd learned into their new album, as well as adding a new member.
Davey Hughes joined on bass, and he was also a really good songwriter, and so he got a lot of words finished. I mean, I guess we'd played tours by this point, and so we wanted a bit more power in the sound.
John again showing me how those months in America changed the songs for the next Trash Can Sinatra's album. Can you play any of that?
Oh, that's a beautiful song.
To the place where I belong, given big blows.
See the space?
To what my heart knows. Old hat, an old story.
I get a little red, and I'll burst rather than wax and melt. The torture flies. Now that's gone, I'm on so long. We know where our love lies. Through the catacomb below,
touring and leaving home had inspired the theme of the new Trash Can Sinatra's album. I love I've seen everything sung, John. I love the fact that it was at a time when you were going to leave, you were going to go off to America. There's kind of a sadness in that song as well. There's a sense of regret about leaving.
It was a feeling of kind of sadness. And the melody, and at that point in our lives, we were kind of leaving town a lot. We were going to tour, and we were just apart a lot. And there was relationships which were beginning to split. Relationships you had with like people you knew at school and just street pals you'd grew up with were beginning to fade or change. But the whole notion of going away and we're leaving and it's going to be all right and there's regrets. Yeah, it's beautiful, beautiful music.
All their touring over, the Trash Can Sinatras returned to Shabby Road to finish work on their second album.
We were starting to realise, you know, we are the kind of people, at least at the moment, who need to maybe hunker down somewhere, lock the world away. And we'd bought this place, so we just made sure that we got a producer who was willing to come up, who could cajole us, you know. It was again, we were learning about finding the right people to work with. And so we ended up with this guy called Ray Showman, who, his personality was just, he knew how to poke fun at us, because we could be like, at least I could be kind of dour and self-conscious, you know, and a little, what do you mean? But he kind of would poke fun at me and make me laugh and laugh at myself. So he was great. That's to me, I've Seen Everything's a much, much more pleasant experience to make.
One of the standout tracks on I've Seen Everything is The Hairy Years. Thank you.
I lingered with a near shot of the seaside souvenir shop. The chief anger sweating on a snow scene. Little puppy eyes down. A tiny world is at death. Detective is descending.
That's a song about getting caught shoplifting when I was on my summer holidays.
There he is, a song about getting caught shoplifting. Tell us more.
Well, it's more than that, but yeah. That's where it started off. I remember when I was younger.
How old were you?
I must have been about 9 or something.
And what happened?
I went on my holidays to Butlins and had a bit of, you know, I'd saved up 50 pence or something for my holiday money. Went there, and the tradition was when you go on your holiday, when you come back, you bring a present for your granny. And I saw a little, it was like a little bird, decorative bird with a holiday camp name on it, and I nicked it. But the feeling of stepping out of my life, and I was Catholic, you know, I'd grown up, and at that stage I was still, confession was a big thing, and you'd come out and you'd feel like, yes, brilliant, you know.
Yeah. And I've been resolved.
I've been resolved, you know, yes. An elated sort of feeling of life. It was always serious. So for me to step out of that life and do something which was totally against everything, it was kind of exciting. So it was just, I sort of, when I think back, and it was quite a shift in my life to step out of what I've been told and taught.
Can you play any of that?
Yeah.
Out for a spell I was slated. I'd lost a yard I was hated. I dug a rug out the dugout, leasing a joint in the turnout.
By about 95, 96, we were living in Shabby Road. We were all living in the studio. It was a large property. Well, money was getting tight, and so it was saving on rent for our apartments. And there was room for all of us, as well as for rehearsal room bands. So we ended up there. We would spend most of our time in the kitchen, or making our breakfast, then making our lunch, and then maybe working during the night. We'd take a look out the window and watch the kind of like Thursday, Friday, Saturday night, you know, kind of carnage as everyone came out of the pubs, spilled out, and tried to get their taxis and their lumbers together. And we'd just be watching all that, really.
We'd go to the quiz on a Monday night.
This is the pub near
across
your
the
bar.
Road.
Yeah,
just across the way. And there was a pop quiz machine. And I think the big thing with the pop quiz machine was
like full lights and asking questions about pop music, Abba's number ones and all that sort
of
stuff.
All that. But the major thing was, if you won through to the money bit, there was two choices, the Rolling Stones and the Beatles. And Frank and Paul are huge Beatles, they know, and it's always the Beatles, every time, 20 quid, every time.
You'd win 20 quid every time?
Yeah, it'd be like a night out, you know, then, you know, back then.
The Trash Cans had high hopes for their new record, I've Seen Everything, particularly in the US.
The first album, Cake, was really well received in American radio. The sound of it really suited things at the time. I think American radio at that time was beginning to play things like the Smiths and maybe Aztec Karma, things that were a bit more melodic and interesting lyrically. Our album really slotted in well with that and got lovely airplay, and we expected the second record to hopefully have the same sort of impact. But in the months before our record came out, that's when Nirvana started to hit the radio, and Nirvana's Kids. So that their whole playlist just shifted. And our first single was a kind of piano-driven, melodic, not very repetitive piece of music, which I love, a song called Hay Fever. And of course it bombed on the radio. But one lovely thing was the Beavis and Butthead decided to play the video. So that got like, at the time that was one of the biggest programmes where they would play music, and it was a big exposure for us. I think they played maybe about a minute of the video, which was great. You know, the song's very well known and well loved out of our catalogue. I think a lot of it's because of that.
And then eventually we got to see it, and the two Beavis guys. Beavis has gone, "That's this Nancy Boys. What is this?" And they were totally confused by the.
Tell me about the tour album.
Happy Pocket, Sprawling. It's a jangly record, but it doesn't jangle. It just has this kind of veil over it because we were so like 24/7 in Shabby Road by that point. You know, we were like, things were starting to sort of grow around us, if I remember rightly. We were being outnumbered by cats and pigeons and keeping our head above water and all that stuff as the record company started to kind of like back off a wee bit from what I remember. So
how does that happen? Did not return calls or emails?
Well, no, they returned them. Too many calls.
One of the big things was a change in A&R men. Simon, the fella who'd first spotted us, left the label round about when we were doing our second record, and there was a different A&R man come in, and that makes a massive difference. The person who loves you and really gets what you do isn't there anymore, and you've got to go through other people.
And the Trash Cans weren't that keen about getting aboard the latest music trend.
Like, that was when Britpop was, right? 1995, 96. So maybe we could hook the Trash Cans to the old Britpop thing, you know? So there was a wee bit of that kind of talk, you know, and hey, why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? And we ended up, I think, on just like kind of reasonably kind of like huffy terms with them, you know. We were like, okay, so this isn't working, and we don't really want to, you know, do remixes of album tracks to make them sound Britpop-esque.
The Trash Cans wouldn't change their sound or their music. This is a song called Safecracker off their third album.
This flight to Tarantula, this jugular to Dracula, me and my Ford Spectacular, you'll be drawn. I'll smash your masterpiece, the bits and pieces on your mantelpiece. In and out in no time, safe. Got impaled on a nail. Once I left the trail behind me, bloody tale to no avail. Better get cracking, it's not safe. Chop you in and catch you out, but me and my thoughts spectacular won't be caught. They call me thrifty, thrifty. I count out to 50. The gallon'll get me into.
It was a prolific time for the Trash Cans, with four different singles taken off that Happy Pocket album.
How do you have a hit? No one knows what a hit is. You know, there's a lot of luck involved.
But they remain grateful to the boss of Go Discs, who had first signed them and kept them recording.
Andy McDonald had taken us from clueless teenagers to this point, and he was still enthusiastic. And so, you know, he'd stuck by us, and it was obvious that, you know, we wanted to give Go Discs what they thought, what they saw in us. You know, we wanted to be successful for them.
The nature of the things were, you know, we didn't get played in the radio too much. We never became one of the things where it was cool. But
did that disappoint you?
Well, I think at the time, yeah, there was a lot of frustration because, and yet, when you've got that sort of debt's hanging over you and you want to be the good guy, you know, it can mess your head a little bit and it can get you down. And the overall mindset for us was maybe, let's fling everything at this record song-wise because it might be the last one.
Cause just throw it out.
Yeah, if we don't sell records here, you know, we can all shake hands and say we give it a good shot, you know.
Back at Shabby Road, John has a memory of those last make or break sessions.
With the drum kit out there one morning.
Yeah, the drum kit out there.
Yeah, and we recorded, there's a song called Outside. It's the instrumental song that starts off our Happy Pocket record. And the whole record starts with the sound of out there, the birds, and just the morning air. Stephen counts the thing in and we recorded the kit out there. I think it was maybe 6-7 in the morning as the sun was rising. We recorded that, and it's lovely to put that record on and suddenly I'm transported back to that morning when we did that.
Yeah, by that point things had gotten a little more desperate. We could feel that maybe Godis weren't going to stick with us for the 6 albums they said they would. It was kind of like the party's over, or the party's now taking on a darker turn, you know.
In the end, it wasn't Godiscs who pulled the plug. The label was taken over by Polygram, and Andy MacDonald left soon after. The Trash Cans were dropped and faced a massive debt, including a huge tax bill which hadn't been paid. The first thing they lost was their Shabby Road studio.
Remember there being a skip outside where stuff was getting put in, you know.
Stuff was getting put into a
skip.
Yeah,
like, you know.
Jeez, that's terrible.
Like baffles and studio things, and there it is in a skip. Yeah, I think that, I mean, because
it's a very kind of public,
yeah.
It's a very public way of seeing these guys, their dreams are over.
And it was sad because we lost the studio, we lost our, you know, our homes, basically. And ended up in like a really bad situation. It was the typical story of the tax man didn't get kind of adhered to, and we thought it was.
They made the band bankrupt, and then at the end of that period, they started making us individually bankrupt, personally bankrupt, just to make it last even longer.
It was ridiculous because we threw everything we had at it to get out of the debt. And
what did you do? Would sell off instruments?
Oh yeah, pensions. We got somebody said, "Oh, just do that and that'll be fine." And we'd do that, and then it wouldn't be fine. And then, you know, with interest, things were back up to what they were by the time we were 2 months down the line. And eventually, from what I remember, Paul, he ended up in front of a panel in the county court.
With the other band members not in Scotland, it fell to guitarist Paul to make the case for the band in court.
And so I wrote a letter. It was easy to make it simple and innocent because I had no idea really what was going on. So I did that, and then I went to this meeting, and there's some old general guy, like, and he seemed really cool. He'd put a bit of time into his look. And he was just sitting there and he's reading the letter, and there was a couple of young folk for the tax
officials.
Yeah. And they were eager to get on with it, and he was like, "I'm reading this letter." And then he said, "It seems to me that this young man and his friends have suffered enough here, and I think they're just trying to go about their business in as best way as they can, and they just had a bit of bad luck.
Seems to me the only fair thing to do is to end this bankruptcy and stop this nonsense."
And so it was a total triumph.
One of many.
Meanwhile, bandmate John was busking in the London Underground.
The taxman came and took our studio, and there was a lot of financial depressing things. And I ended up in London, I wasn't earning, so I decided to go, just get up early and go out and go busking. Mostly in the underpasses. And Leave Me Alone was one of our songs that I would do, and people would stop, and the buskers would say, "Where'd you get that? Whose song's that?" And then they'd be surprised when I'd say, "Oh, it's one of mine." So it was in those little tunnels, there's great reverbs. I'd go to like Hyde Park Corner or Marble Arts Corner. Hyde Park Corner was quite funny because the tax offices were just outside there.
They'd been your ruination.
Yeah. So I was getting busking money off them.
Off tax men, yes. On their lunch breaks.
Yeah, so that was my payback.
Do you want to play it there?
Yeah, I'll give that a go.
I'm not sad at all. I can see beyond the hardest thing of all. Goodbye. Leave me alone. You're all I wanted. Don't haunt me now. Don't want you now. Leave me alone. I found what I meant.
Without a record label or a studio, things looked pretty bleak for the Trash Can Sinatras. But the internet was about to change everything. Scottish musicians were astonished to find out they were popular on the World Wide Web with a news group specially dedicated to them.
Well, throughout all of these years of quietness, people would talk about us obsessively.
Yeah, well, the internet saved us. It gave us a direction to go in. We had been told about it in 95, quite early, by this friend of ours, Simon. And he'd clued us into this thing. There's this thing, the internet. You know, it's going to be big. Watch out! So we watched out, and we started to get involved with a guy in America who knew his way around it enough to start chat rooms. And we, you know, for the first time, we had direct contact with fans, and people were saying, "Oh, you guys are great," and that was kind of new to us. People seemed to be quite interested in us still. And that was another little boost, you know, along with any songs that we had. And so we started to explore it.
From the internet came offers to tour Japan, then an invitation to return to America to record a new album.
The Japanese record label recommended this guy to go and work with, an American producer, and had a studio in Hartford, Connecticut. And it was part of the old Colt gun factory in Connecticut, a big sort of two or three level warehouse, huge thing. You get buildings like this in Manchester, a bit like big warehouses.
Yeah.
So we went over there with the notion of, we'll go in, we'll set up our instruments, we'll get some nice sounds, and we'll just play for 2 weeks, and we'll take the best takes, and that'll be the record. So we were all living there in this place, you know,
in Connecticut, in this big warehouse.
In this big warehouse on mattresses and sleeping bags.
What kind of an area was it in?
It was kind of on the border between the Hispanic area and the kind of industrial estate area.
So it's a dangerous area.
Yeah, not a lot around the place where we were. It was, but at night
you'd hear gunshots.
You'd hear gunshots, and Mike would be, that's a AK-73 or that's a that's a Colt something.
And did that scare you?
Well, it was off-putting, but it was just part of the day. We felt safe in the place we were in.
Returning to Scotland, the Trash Cans realised the songs they recorded sounded too down and too slow for a comeback album from a band who'd been away for 5 years.
Yeah, it was just a depressing thing, and we came home with nothing and went back into our separate little places that we lived and kept away from each other. And then eventually Frank came to my flat and he's like, "Look, what are we doing here? Are we going to do this or not?" And so he'd had enough, and he sort of came and gave us all a shake, and we decided to record the songs that we had as best we could, and that would be it. But then yeah, John wrote Weightlifting, and it just seemed like it summed the whole thing up, how we felt. Like,
from then on, I think they kind of weightlifted, as they say, and we started kind of like gathering together with our guitars again.
Discover the wheel and watch the buildings go by. You talk a little soft, turn off the radio. I just wanna hear all the pastimes, the rushed hours, the endless lies. Don't become a
a couple of years later, we just decided to go and do it again, and we'd some up songs. We'd finish some of the more kind of not cheery, but you know, songs that made the record feel balanced. There's songs like It's a Miracle, and Paul's got a beautiful one called Free Time. Paul and his friend Jody, they would go to Arran, this island across the way, across the coast from Irvine, and they would just hike up into the hills. I'd just spend a couple of days. He'd be away from all the band, away from all the music, sitting with his mate, forgetting about it, watching the, you know, the clouds go by and the glorious scenery. And then he wrote this song called Free Time about it all. He said he was walking up the hill and he had some loose change in his pocket. And as he was walking up the hill, there was a rhythm. And that's the first line. It's like the rhythm of change.
Because the rhythm of change will carry on beating. I'll take these blue skies, however.
The Trash Can Sinatra's album Weightlifting was released on August 31st, 2004. It was their first record in 8 years, and they've kept recording and releasing records ever since. But there have been more battles along the way, including John getting sick in 2013.
You've gone through illness yourself. Was that a tough thing to go through? What happened to you?
I caught a thing called ulcerative colitis, major pancolitis. It was my whole colon just attacked itself. It thought there was something in there and there wasn't, but so it was attacking itself. One Christmas, blood pouring out of me, and I went in, and the guy says, I'm going to knock you out to do this because you're bleeding, it might be painful. So they put the camera in, and I woke up, and the guy said, it's not cancer. And I said, well, I'd never heard that word before, but I'm glad it's in that sentence. And he said, it's ulcerative colitis, and you've gone, your things are going to be different, you know. Eventually, it was a year of surgery. I had three
surgeries.
I think it was a guy from Cork, Mr. Malloy from Cork, was
a surgeon from Cork.
Surgeon from Cork.
Sage.
Fabulous. Yeah. 8 hours I was in the theatre, and I woke up and I said to the guy, how big was the thing you took out of me? And he says, see, my arm was the size of my arm.
Did you think he could have died during all that?
When I looked back on it and I realised what was happening to me, yeah, if I'd have got that condition maybe 20 years previously, there wouldn't have been an operation to help me.
You'd be dead?
Yeah, I'd be gone. Yeah, it was basically massive internal bleeding. And it would have been curtains.
Family,
John,
noticed
you go through
it,
something like that, and so life-threatening. Does that make you get up in the morning and see the world differently,
absolutely.
The day differently? It's like absolutely a whole life-changing thing. You see absolutely the world in a new light.
Yeah, every day is like a joyous thing. You know, you look at everything and like, wow, it's miraculous.
Because you might not be
like seeing those plants.
Yeah.
They are wafting in the sunshine. What the heck's that? What a beautiful thing. It's one of my best days on earth. 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 One of my best days. It's the line itself is one of my best days on earth. The nuances to that are lovely. You know, I'm only here for a while and I'll be somewhere else in a bit. But while I'm here, this is a great day while I'm here. Paul's great at that, finding an unusual angle on a mundane thing.
If there's a place to end our story, it has to be back outside the Trash Can's old studio. Well, I bring you back here and you're standing outside what was Shabby Road Studios.
Yeah.
How does that make you feel, John?
I just see Paul's enthusiastic face and Frank smiling and laughing. And Stephen as well, and Davey, just as all enjoying the process and of working away at something and then being able to press play. And it sounds, you know, amazing. And stuff we could go and take on the world with. That's what we did in there. We built these big ships and went out into the world.
Big ship songs.
Yeah, big giant redwood songs, absolutely, yeah.
Split up, and that's it. People feel
like
giving it their best go. Why didn't the Trash Can
Sinatra split up? It's what's driven us from, in living my memory anyway, past 20 odd years, it's been one song after another that has to be done. I think we had just had a couple of songs that we really liked, you know. We sort of had, like, we should at least finish that, you know, that's too good to leave behind.
We've always thought, look, as long as our records are good, we'll be alright. And we've always thought that, which is probably why we're still doing it, because we're just like, eventually, this is all going to work out for the best and we can wipe out the mistakes of the past. I mean, we don't think that anymore. The only thing that you're left to show for all your years of effort and everything is not the stories of silliness, it's the actual music. And I think we've put enough of ourselves into each recording that, you know, people are going to pick up on that.
The word success is funny. It's basically about people enjoying what you do. And if people enjoy what you do, then, you know, you tend to think not so selfishly about it. You think about it as some sort of service, something that's useful to folks. And that's always been the way. You know, there's a bunch of people out there that get a lot out of our music, and it would seem a bit selfish to stop doing it.
This programme is dedicated to Stuart Robertson. The Trash Can Sinatras was narrated and produced by Ken Sweeney. Sound editing by Billy Farrell at Dead Eye Productions. Additional voices by Morgan C. Jones.
Radio Nova, seriously addictive.